Hello, California. My name's Harold, and I'm an alcoholic.
Harold.
It's great to be here. It's a privilege to be here. My sobriety date is April 7th, 1987. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and my home group is AA on the Rocks. Meets on Wednesday nights. If you're ever in St. Louis, I hope you look us up. It's Strong Three Legacy Group. Meets in the Shaw neighborhood. And if you get a hold of me early enough, I will put you to work. I'll get some mileage out of you if you come to St. Louis. I come from a great line of sponsorship. My sponsor's here tonight. He's actually sitting right there. So if there's any problems with what I share tonight, that's who you go talk to. That's the director. And you heard him share last night, and just a great guy. And I'll talk more about how we got connected in a little bit. I want to just thank June, my friend June, and the committee for inviting me to come and Steve to come. And, you know, it takes a lot of work to put these things on. And I'm not sure if I'm at a spring event or a winter event, but whatever it is, you know. I think I could sell a lot of scarves and hats and mittens this weekend if I needed to. But it's great to be here. It really takes a lot of work. And I want to lift up, you know, Encore Audio and Visual and Billy and that team, and really ask you to support those guys, because I don't want to say they're a dying breed, but it's definitely in a downward trend, friends, because of the world of technology and how it's growing. And it's easy to pirate everything we do and just do it for free and for fun. And people that put a lot of sweat equity and a lot of their own money to come out and make these things happen and record these things, they don't do this for free. It costs money to do this stuff, so support them. And it's easy to get a flash drive uploaded on a Google and share the drive with 100,000 people, but it really takes away. So I just hope you show them some love this week and continue to do that. I just thank all of our speakers that have come before, Sue and Steve, of course, and Lynn and the old long-timers panel, and H&I with Angela, and the young people we just heard from, Kyle. And so it's beautiful. It's been a great conference for me. It's given me a chance to spend a lot of time with Steve one-on-one and catch up with him on a lot of things. And before I dive in too fast to my story, I want to share a little bit about my week coming here, because there's been a lot of it's a beautiful thing, but it's a challenge. And I want to read, if I could, the Grapevine quote. I don't know how many of you read the Grapevine quote or get that. But this is the daily quote today from the Grapevine, and it was very fitting for me. And this is what it says, and I quote, it says, "Peace and enlightenment come when you stop evaluating in terms of good or bad and merely accept all of life as it is and try to learn from it," end quote. And that's a powerful statement for me. I left St. Louis last Tuesday and went to Austin, Texas, and I went there for a couple reasons. One was a work event, and it was a conference there for that. But one was to see a lifelong friend in AA, a friend of several of you here, who's on the last stages of his life, you know, battling an illness that's going to take his life, and been sober a long time. And to spend two different days with him, and my last night there to sit with him, you know, by his bedside and just talk about recovery, talk about this journey and what it's meant to us. And just, you know, we talked about everything from this life to what the afterlife might look like, to, you know, regrets that we had. If we had to do it all over again, what we'd do different. We had a lot of really deep theological discussion, and it was powerful for me. It was humbling for me to be in that space with him. But to watch his swagger and to watch his commitment to and his faith demonstrated. You know, alcoholics are like tea bags. You don't know what they're made of until you put them in hot water, all right? And you get to see what people are made of. And so it was beautiful for me to have that experience. But the whole time I'm here, I'm blessed to have a really great life. And I'll share more about that in a little bit. But I'm a dad to five kids, four daughters and one son. It's God's way of getting even with me with all these girls in my life, right? But we have four grandchildren, and one daughter has all four of them. Two of them, you know, naturally, and then two were adopted from Mexico. But it's a powerful little family we got. And these kids couldn't say my name Harold, so they started calling me Grandpa Harry. So that's my name in my house now, is Grandpa Harry. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit. But two of the kids, the youngest ones, the natural born ones that they brought into the world, have both been in the hospital all week, and they've been in ICU. They caught a viral infection, a para influenza 3, they call it, And the little one, who's only 2 months old, yesterday while we were here, had to be life-flighted by a helicopter to Children's Hospital in Denver. The good news is, because there's a lot of people praying for him, and I ask you to pray for him, and their names are Anna and Atlas. Anna's been downgraded, and she finally came home, still really sick, but she's home. But Atlas is only 2 months old. He's out of ICU now, but he's stable, but he's still got a long way to go. And so we've been dealing with that all week, trying to manage that from here. But to be surrounded with sponsorship here and a lot of great friends, able to navigate that while we're here and stay present, be present, and have a great time with that. But I just want to be transparent. That's been my week leading into tonight. But I'm grateful to be here. I think it's on page 105 of Bill Season. It's the title of that page, if I'm correct, says it's titled Chief Responsibility. If you go about halfway down that page, it says that our, and I'm paraphrasing, but it says our chief responsibility is to deliver an adequate demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous to the newcomer. And if we take that even deeper to, it's not only my responsibility, but it's our group's responsibility, it's our district, our area, this conference responsibility to deliver an adequate demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new tonight and you're here, I hope this weekend has been that for you. I hope it's been an adequate demonstration of what this life of recovery can be like. And it's, you know, we've heard a lot of people share the good news, but I'm here to tell you it's not just good news. It's the best news ever if you're suffering from a hopeless state of mind and body and your life's upside down. So wherever you're at on your spiritual journey, you know, as we say a lot, come all the way in, sit all the way down, and stay. And staying is the hard part here. It truly is the hard part. I'm from the Ozark Mountains. Maybe you can pick up on that a little bit. I got a little bit of country in me. And I've lived a lot of places over the South. And I'm from the Ozark Mountains. And I know right off the bat, a lot of people go, I know about Ozark. I watched that show on Netflix. All right? Marty Bird and Darlene and Wyatt and Ruth. So, you know, you think you have the insight on the hillbillies. But I can just tell you, whether you know it or not, there's a little bit of hillbilly genius that goes on. So I don't usually do it, but I am tonight. I'm going to share with you a little bit of a hillbilly parable. And if you get this, we'll connect great the rest of the weekend. If not, you have another speaker in the morning, man. You're really going to want to leave it here. But I'll share this story. It's about two hillbillies named Bubba and Daryl. Pretty popular names in our back of the woods, even in Steve's backyard. And Bubba and Daryl, they grew up in the same little rural town their whole life. Lived on the same gravel road, knew everybody, everybody knew them. And one night, Bubba calls the sheriff. He says, Sheriff, I need to report Daryl. And he started laughing. He goes, what are you reporting Daryl for? He says, because he's doing illegal things at his house. He said, what kind of illegal things? He said, he's selling, I think, drugs. He goes, what are you talking about? He says, yeah, all these cars go down the gravel road late at night. And they just go down all hours of night. You can't sleep. They make all kinds of noise. They got all this music going on. So I snuck down there the other night and I watched from the woods. I sat inside the woods and I watched as they came and he came out of the house and they flashed their lights and they went out back to this wood pile where he's got all this wood. And they reach in the wood pile and he pull out stuff and he hand it to him and they spend money. He goes, are you being serious? He goes, I'm being as serious as I can be. He goes, well, Bubba, that's a serious, serious accusation you're making against your lifelong friend. He goes, I know, but something's got to happen. He says, well, we'll check it out. So the next night, here comes Barney Fife and Roscoe Pico Coltrane and the fine police establishment of Izzard County come in the middle of the night and beat on the door. And Daryl comes to the door and they said, we're here to investigate. And they go, okay, what's going on? He says, well, we got some insight that you might be doing some illegal things. We need to, he goes, you're going to search my house? He goes, no, we really want to search your backyard. We want to search your wood pile. And they go back to the wood pile, and they got axes and log splitters. And he says, all right, boys, go through it all. Don't leave a log untouched. And they cut up all this wood. They go through this entire thing. And they don't find anything. And they leave, and they're out of their minds. They're mad as hell. And the next morning, Bubba calls Daryl. He said, Daryl, what are you doing? He goes, oh, I'm just getting up. He says, hey, the sheriff come to your house last night? He goes, man, he sure did. He said, did they cut up all that wood you got in the back? He said, he sure did. He says, happy birthday, buddy. All right. So that's how we roll. Um, I'm going to share with you what I call the four H's. I'm going to share with you my history with alcohol, how that brought me into a relationship with you, and how that brought me into a relationship with the power greater than myself. I'm going to share a lot of heartbreak that came out of that. I'm going to share some stories about some heroes of mine, and then ultimately I'm going to share about the hope that this program, this way of life, has to offer you. I was born to the greatest mother on the planet. Her name is Mama Long. She passed away in 2015. Greatest winner of my life. A woman that was married to two alcoholics, first one being in St. Louis, where she had a son and two daughters that came out of that marriage. And the insanity and the darkness that went on with that was enough to force her out of that house. She just left, and she was gone for 10 years, MIA. Nobody knew if she was alive, if she was dead, she was just gone. And she resurfaced in Nevada, Missouri, which is right on the Oklahoma-Texas border. She resurfaced there. And she was a patient in a state mental hospital that's still active there today. That's where my mother landed. And after some time, she was able to get out. And when she got out, she met another alcoholic who happened to be my father. And I came out of that marriage. And after about two or three years into it, my mom just had enough of the insanity. The train, the circus was all going again. And she ran him off. And she just turned her will and life over to her care of God as she understood God. Her parents died young. She didn't have any brothers or sisters. It was just her. No education, divorced twice in the 60s. Not a good stigma to have on in trying to make it as a single mom. But she just made a commitment. She turned her will and life over to her Catholic roots, and she never looked back. She never wavered from that day till the rest of her life. She matured, and she blossomed into an amazing woman. And I'm biased because I'm a mama's boy, but I will tell you, I just don't think there's anything more beautiful than a woman who's walked with God for a long time. And we have a lot of those women here today. And they're beautiful to watch. They're beautiful to engage with. And my mom was one of those people. She was the greatest winner. My mom told me she loved me just about every day of her life. She wanted me to know about this higher power that she put her faith in through her Catholic roots. So she put me in a parochial school. We lived in a little bitty house. We shared a bathroom with a lady next door. I mean, we just didn't have much. But I had everything a kid could want. I had a mother who loved me, who was trying to give me the best that she had. And so I went to a Catholic school from kindergarten to the fourth grade. And I'm not one of these recovering Catholics that get up here and say, you know, look at the scars on my hands from where the nuns beat me with rulers, or I got bald spots where they pulled out hair in my head. As far back as I remember, I loved all that stuff. You know, I loved it all. I loved it enough that I'd come home and play church sometimes. I'd get out TV trays and make an altar and take an Afghan or a blanket, throw it over, make it look good. Take the fruit out of the fruit bowl, fill it full of potato chips for the Eucharist. Right? Get some grape Kool-Aid for the wine. Get a Bible out, I can promise you we never read. And get a towel out for a stole, bring a few guys over, save a few souls. It was a great day at the Longhouse, right? The rock operas were out. Tommy and Godspell and Hair and Jesus Christ Superstar. The Jesus Revolution was going on in your backyard. You know, we just had that movie that came out. I mean, all this stuff was going on at that time of my life, and it was driving my life. It was shaping my life. I could sing all those soundtracks backwards and forwards as we stay here today. They all had a spiritual theme. They all had a spiritual overtone. It all set the ball in motion. I was a rock and roll drummer, and I was gifted at it. I started playing drums when I was about five, and I was gifted at it. I was also a really good ball player, baseball player. Had I not met King Alcohol, I don't know if I've ever been good enough to play for the Cardinals, but I probably could have played for the Giants. I'm just saying. Maybe, right? Maybe. I don't know. But that's how my life started out. But then the shift happened. Then the big shift happened, and my mom laid a bomb on me. And she came, and I was probably between 8 and 9. She said, look, we're going to move. And I said, we're going to move where? She said, we're going to move to the outskirts of St. Louis. And I said, why? And she said, because you got a brother and two sisters you don't know about. And it was her attempt to reconcile. It was her attempt to make a nine-step amends to these kids that she just left, MIA gone. And that threw me for a loop. And we moved, and we made this big shift from this little country town to St. Louis. And this delusion of what I would call the delusion of inequality, this imposter narrative, we've heard about it all weekend from all of our speakers. They described it in their own way, their own language. They articulated how it impacted them as a square peg trying to fit in a round hole. I never felt like I fit in. You know, I felt like everybody had the answers to the test but me. I mean, all the ways we try to describe this inadequacy, this delusion of inequality, that I'm not enough, just who I am. a delusion that can still impact my life today if I'm not transparent, if I'm not connected and spiritually grounded. I can still fall into that trap very easily. It's by default. But that imposter narrative, and it didn't, I can't remember, to be transparent, I can't really remember it driving my life until we moved there. But once we moved there, we could no longer go to the private school. We went from a town, small town, maybe 100 kids in school, to a school of thousands. And so now I'm just, my whole life's upside down. And I look at myself, and I don't look right. I look like a little country kid, and now it's the 70s, and people were wearing big bell-bottom pants. Anybody wear those? I mean, and those were fashion. So immediately I went home and made this grand announcement to my mother. I got to change everything. I'm not cool. I'm lame. I suck. And so I changed everything overnight. What you thought about me paralyzed me. You absolutely owned me. And I had no idea that was going on. It was very much at a subconscious level. But I was willing to change everything. So I changed the way I dressed. I started wearing big bell-bottom pants. I got the brown suede boots with the red shoestrings. Billy Jack was a badass in TV. So I wore Billy Jack t-shirts. I had a blue jean jacket. I grew my hair real long. I took the thumbtack out of my Kiss poster, pierced my ear. I made a headband out of a piece of belt. I had gap teeth. I had freckles. I had pimples. I looked like a freaked out Howdy Doody, if you ever know what that is. I mean, seriously, that's what I looked like. It was pathetic. But it looked cool at the time. And I'm trying to be cool. I was a rock and roll drummer, so I was invited into circles I didn't really have any business being in. I hang around kids I didn't, way older than I was. My mom was gone all the time working all kinds of jobs. So by the time I was 10, I just came and gone as I pleased. And living in dark spaces, doing dark things started to happen. By the time I was 10, 11 years old. Smoking cigarettes and drugs came into place, you know, street drugs at the time. My drug of choice at that time was don't mind if I do. You know, you want to try some of this? Sure, I don't mind if I do. I'll try it. I've probably done birth control more than once. You know, who knows? That's how I started out, you know, in life. And my mom drank her whole life. My mom drank her entire life till the day she died. And she was cheap. She had to be for survival skills. And that just never left her. Even when she got a little bit more prominent in her later years, you know, and started to accumulate some things, she still was cheap. She always had the cheapest beer, whatever was on sales, Hams Light, Schlitz, whatever, PBR, she had it. And she always had a fifth of Old Crow underneath the drink. Some of the people called it the Dirty Bird. And did I drink some of that stuff? Did I drink some altar wine as a little altar boy? Yes to all those things. But I don't really count any of that stuff my first real dance with King Alcohol. My first real dance with King Alcohol came between age 10 and, or 11 and 12. My buddy was a bandmate of mine. He was 17 years old. His parents were in Florida. And he said, hey, man, I'm having a get-together at the house. Come over to the house. Never been to a party before in my life. And I went to the house. And go in, there's dope, there's girls, there's booze. There's everything you'd ever dream of at a party. Never been to nothing like it in my life. He's behind the bar playing the bartender. His dad's gone to Florida. And I step up and he asked me the all-important question, what are you drinking? Well, nobody ever asked me that before in my life. I had no idea how to answer it. I said, I guess whatever you're making me is what I'm drinking. And he made me a big glass of sloe gin and Coke. And I went over and sat down on the couch and I finally got the courage to take a pull off it. And it tasted like cough syrup. You know, I said, well, this isn't that big a deal. It tastes like Robitussin. And I took a little bit more and I started to get that sensation we get from King Alcohol for the first time in my life. I started to get a smile on my face like I ain't never had before. And I drank some more and the smile got a little bigger. And I drank some more and it got a little bigger. And eventually it wrapped all the way around my head, man. And it was an apocalyptic moment. Apocalyptic meaning something that's been unveiled that you never experienced before in your life. It changed my life. And I didn't necessarily vocalize at that moment, but I thought it, I'm sure, that I'm going to do this right here for the rest of my life. It was a game changer. It changed my life. It changed the course of history for me. I got as sick as I've ever been off alcohol that night. I know I said my first foxhole prayer, if you would, or first plea bargain prayer that night. I know that I probably lied to my mama that night. I didn't drink the next day, the next week, or maybe even the next month. But there was a major shift. I wanted to live that life. I wanted to do that. And so everything I could do to shift my life to do that, I did. And unfortunately, we had no resources. We had no money. And it led to a life of crime. And it started out with burglaries and petty burglaries that just became bigger burglaries. And before you know it, I was in a lot of trouble. I robbed the manager of our trailer. We lived in a trailer park. We moved from little country town to this beat-up trailer park where they called everybody trailer trash. That's where I lived at. But the manager of this place, I robbed their trailer park and robbed them and got arrested and got put on indefinite probation. And then I got arrested some more again, and I got sent to a boys' juvenile home for the first time. There's a lot of delusions that drive our life, and I'm going to talk about a lot of those tonight as I talk about the history and the heartache that came with it. But this delusion, one of the delusions I had, and maybe you had it too, was that I wasn't afraid of nothing. Seriously, when I came to AA and you would have started to help me make a fears list, I would have just said, I'm not afraid of nothing. If you want to fight about it, let's just go fight about it. Seriously, I mean, this is the delusion. But what I'm about to share with you, when they talk about 100 forms of fear, self-pity, self-delusion driving our life, well, this is what they're talking about. It drove my life. What you thought of me paralyzed me. It controlled everything I did, said, acted, how I felt. It did everything. And we're on the way to this boys' camp, this juvenile detention center. I've never been there before in my life. And this committee in my head, I don't know if you have a committee in your head, but these voices, call them the isms, the dark side, the lower power, the enemy, the devil himself, whatever, I call them the boys. How many are there? Well, if I had to see a counselor, they'd charge me a group rate. I can promise you that. There's a lot of noise going on. The imposter narrative, and this is what it said. You know, you can't go to an all-guys camp with the name Harold, because the name Harold sucks. And they had my attention. I'm starting to think about, well, who do I know named Harold? Well, my dad's name was Harold, who I only saw a few times, but he never went by that. The only show on TV at the time was a cartoon called Fat Albert. Came in on Saturday. Some of you remember that show? Hey, hey, hey. And the dumbest guy on that show was named Harold. And then there was an Alka-Seltzer commercial. Some of you are old enough to remember this commercial. And this Alka-Seltzer commercial was a kind of a chunky guy with pajamas on, sitting on the edge of his bed with a major indigestion. And he hollers through the house and he said, I can't believe I ate the whole thing. There you go. God bless you. And his wife responds with, Harold, you did eat the whole thing. So that was my only two references to the name Harold. There was nobody in Rambo or Dirty Dancing. There was nobody. And my middle name's Eugene, so you can't be a badass with that name, right? And my last name's Long, so if you take that acronym, it spells hell. And that's what it was like trying to be cool, fancy, and free. But an hour and a half up the highway to go to this juvenile detention center, I changed my name to Jeffrey Allen Long, and I stayed that till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I would have told you I wasn't afraid of anything when I got here. This is all the delusion that this malady that we've talked a lot about this weekend instilled in me, drove my life. I went to that place, I got out of that place, and I got arrested and sent to the penitentiary for the first time. And I started my journey in the Department of Corrections. And I'm not going to go through all that. I can just tell you, I quit school by the time I was 13. I found my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1979. I just came out of Boonville Correctional Center, and I was sitting in a detention center in Adair County, Missouri. I was arrested for another charge. And while I was in there, they brought AA in there. And that was my first introduction to it. My parole officer and the prosecutor at the time gave me a plea bargain offer on this charge. They said, we're going to do you a favor. You can either go back and do 2.5 more years, or you can go to treatment for 30 days. Now, I quit school when I was 13, but I had enough math in me to know that 30 days was a hell of a lot shorter than 2.5 years. So I took the plea bargain. I went to treatment for the first time in 1980, and I was introduced to AA on the outside. And it was 12-step based. Most of the people were all just members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they sent you to outside meetings. They didn't have a lot of internal meetings. And they throw you on a bus. This is a rural town up by Iowa, Kirksville, Missouri, to be exact. And they drove you out to these little farming communities to go to AA. And I remember going into my first AA meeting in La Plata, Missouri. And there was a lady named Millie Mays. She's passed away now. But Millie was just a saint in AA, if there is such a thing, in the mid part of Missouri. Died with 40 plus years. And she was at the meeting, and she met me at the door. And there's only like 15 people in this meeting, but she looked like Mrs. Claus. She had big white hair, big rosy cheeks. She was beautiful. And she got me in, set me down, and I remember like it was yesterday, she bought me an orange crushed soda. But there was not very many people there, so everybody had to talk. And she was just a saint and went around to me, and it finally said, what do you got to say? And I said, well, my name's Jeff, and I'm here because the Department of Corrections said I had to come. I only got about so many days left, and you'll never see me again because I'm not one of you people. And this lady turned on me right in the meeting. She grew horns, fangs, and a tail. Right? Fire kind of shot out of her nose. And she looked right at me. She says, well, you just keep drinking, you dumb little bastard. It's all going to happen to you. And she became my first resentment, Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the beautiful part about AA is many years after that, I spoke at her 40th anniversary at her home group. So it comes full circle. But she was a saint. I got out of treatment, and the Thomas boys picked me up. It's not a good thing if the Thomas boys pick you up from treatment. Johnny and Tommy Thomas, and they got in the back of the pickup. We rode in the back of pickups all the time, and got in the back of the pickup, and they handed me a jug of jungle juice, Everclear, who knows what else was in it. They gave me a piece of blotter acid with a Snoopy on it, and off we went to one of the best parties I've ever been in my life on the Sheraton River. It was awesome. Hundreds of people, lots of bands. It was great. And the highlight of the night is I took that coin I got for 30 days, went down with my buddies, skipped that thing across the river, pounded my chest, made some big hillbilly rebel yell. Like, we survived that, brother. We survived treatment. And that would be the last time I thought about not drinking for a long time. But that's alcoholism. And so I ended up leaving. I hooked up with a guy named Scott who was a drifter. He was a long-haired hippie from Texas. He had an old panel van, a UPS van that he had turned into a living quarters. He was just a drifter, really like a gypsy in my town. He was just hanging out, couch surfing, hanging out, partying, and he was on his way back to Texas. And I said, can I go with you? And then he agreed to that, and off I went. I was just turning 16, and I left, and I spent the next several years, you know, in Texas, Tennessee, and Georgia, just on the run, drinking and just raising 10 kinds of hell, and just one location to the next. And it would be, I landed in Acworth, Georgia. There was a great country artist who's passed away now, Charlie Daniels. Some of you know Charlie Daniels. He wrote a song called The Devil Went Down to Georgia Looking for a Soul to Steal. Well, he found me in Acworth, Georgia. And I was living down there. And this is my first moment of any kind of concession, any kind of conceding that I was powerless over alcohol. Happened at the age of 19 as I'm living in this trailer court. I lived in Red Barn Trailer Court with a bunch of hillbilly rejects from the South. I don't think there was anybody from Georgia even on my street. It was like from North Carolina, Kentucky, Tennessee. And how bad was it? Well, I lived next door to three guys named Porkchop, Hollywood, and Screwdriver. If that gives you any indication how life was going. But what I'm about to share with you, and especially if you're new and you're trying to wrap your mind around, you know, is this thing a malady? Is it an illness? Is it a disease? Come on, is it really a disease? I mean, if it's a disease, it's the only disease that's bottled and sold. I mean, where do you catch the disease? Is it like COVID? How do you catch it? I mean, these are all fair objections, and these are all things that we all wrestle with when we're trying to you know, walk away, if you would, surrender to the love of our life. It was the love of my life, King Alcohol was. You know, and I was living down there, and I was going to the honky-tonks, and I loved the honky-tonks. Loved them. I was a saloonatic. I loved the saloons. If I wasn't playing music in them, I was drinking in them. And I loved girls in tight jeans and white T-tops and cowboy hats. And if they had cowboy boots and if they had a four-wheel drive, God bless America, I loved them even more. You know, I loved that stuff. That was my life. I woke up one morning. I was a blackout drinker from day one. But I woke up one Saturday morning, Acworth, Georgia, living in this old trailer. And on cowboy boots, blue jeans, flannel shirt, and a vest. And I woke up and I was just covered in blood. I had blood all over my jacket, all over my hands. Had a big tomato head. That's what we call a hangover in the South. And I had no idea what happened to me. I was clueless. I figured somebody just kicked the dog snot nasty out of me, because that was not uncommon. I was one of those guys when I went out. It didn't happen every time, but it wasn't uncommon, especially if I was drinking whiskey or mixing it with something else, that somebody wanted to punch me at least once before the night was out. Did any of you have that gift? I had that gift. That was a gift that I did well. So I figured somebody just punched my lights out. And I went into the bathroom, and I couldn't find where I was bleeding from. And as I got undressed, I realized somebody sliced me all around the side and stabbed me in my rib cage. To this day, I can't tell you what happened. But what happened next is what kills most of us. And it's, we talk about the word denial and recovery. We talk about the word denial a lot. But actually, it's a word that's only mentioned twice in the big books. Once on page 10 in Bill's story, and once in the spiritual appendix. And both times it's talking about denying a power greater than herself. Where our book really outlines alcoholism is there's denial. There's denial in every human experience. But the way our book really describes it, and we heard it read here just a little bit ago, is not on the basis of denial, but on the basis of delusion and illusion. Denial means I know it's over there, I'm just not going to look at it. Delusion staring me right in my eyes and I can't see it for what it is. I can't differentiate the true from the false. And that's the dilemma of the alcoholic. I can't see my life the way it really is, despite all the evidence. And this is what it looks like. And this is what this false narrative, coupled with King Alcohol, and why it kills most alcoholics. That very page, page 30, the very first three words, all capital letters, most of us have been unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. Most of us will go to the gates of insanity or death. Most of us will die from alcoholism. Google how many people are considered alcoholics in the world. Compare that to how many people are guesstimated to be in AA. It's not even a close number. It's a fatal illness. And the fact that we're sitting here tonight, whether we got one day sober or we got 55 years sober, it doesn't matter. If we have a desire to stop drinking, man, it's a tremendous gift, and I hope we hang on to it with everything we got, because if we ever drink again, there's no guarantee we'll ever draw a sober breath. But I sat on the front porch of this trailer. It was the first time in my life ever that I remember having any kind of concession to King Alcohol, that I ever can remember in my life ever saying, man, I want to do something different than what I'm doing. First time ever. And as I'm sitting there, King Alcohol, and I love what our authors did. They took King Alcohol, they personified it, and it took an old British character, John Barleycorn, attached it to that. We hear that in our language, in our literature. We hear it in the traditions. But it was just like John Barleycorn was sitting next to me, and this is kind of how the conversation went. Man, I got to do something different. And King Alcohol says, you know what, kid, you're right. You do need to do something different. But before you do anything drastic, let's grab your army jacket and walk up here to the Magic Market and get a quart of beer and a pack of smokes. And for some reason, that sounded like a really rational idea. And I didn't even wash the blood off my hands. I got the army jacket and I started walking up, and that sense of ease and comfort came over me before I ever got there. I was almost skipping to the liquor store before I was halfway there. I got the quart of beer, I got the pack of smokes, I come out, I made that noise we all love, psh, and that spirit come out of that bottle. And I took a pull off it, and made that face we always make, and it was the last time I ever thought about not drinking for a long time. And that's alcoholism, and it had me by my throat. I hitchhiked to Marietta, Georgia, got sewed up, and that was the last time I thought of not drinking for a long time. I ended back in St. Louis in 1985. In 1985, I got arrested for a fourth DWI conviction. A few weeks later, I was involved in a fatality drunk driving accident coming home. I wasn't driving. I was a passenger in the car coming home with my bandmates, but we were involved in an altercation on the highway, and unfortunately, everybody else in the other vehicle lost their life that night. And when I got home after the sun was way up, I was just a crushed human being. It's like somebody took out my soul and literally cut it in half. But there's nothing between you and King Alcohol. If there's nothing between you and anything you're powerless over, you'll succumb to it like that. And literally, with all the heartache, with all the heartbreak in my life, sitting there in that broken old beat-up apartment, the best I could do is walk in and get another can of beer and try to think it through. And only to be drunk again and behind the wheel of a car just a few weeks later, where I was arrested for a 50 WI, felony DWI convictions, parole violation, 21 going on 22, and on my way back to the penitentiary. And I was in St. Louis County Jail. I was quarantined by myself. They had me in my underwear in this drunk tank with the air conditioner on. And it was, and I got down on my knees in that cell. And I said the most honest prayer I've ever said in my life. And it was simply it's a prayer I've heard from this podium a million times. And it was simply, God help me. But the difference between that prayer and all the other prayers, because I said a lot of prayers. Prayers like, God, get me out of this, and I'll never do it again. You all know that prayer. And if you're really alcoholic, you had to add this to it. And this time, I really mean it, right? Because we burnt that prayer to the ground. The prayer had no teeth. It had no legs. But this prayer was different. And the book says that God doesn't make too hard a turn for those who honestly seek God. I didn't know that's what I was doing. It was just an honest prayer. God help me. I don't want to live this way anymore. And I bailed out. I had enough sense to know I needed to go back to treatment for the courts before I went to trial to try to lessen whatever punitive measures were going to come down the pipe. I went back to that same treatment center I was at in 1980. 2.5 hours from St. Louis. Lots of places to go in St. Louis, but I didn't have a relationship with them. I went there, and this is where the adequate demonstration comes full circle, because the demonstrations that were given to me in jail, in the treatment center, even though I rejected what they had to offer me, were adequate demonstrations of this recovery. So I went back. I didn't go there to go to AA for the rest of my life. I didn't go there to get sober necessarily. I went there because it was a safe place and I needed something to stand in front of the judge and say, I'm trying. I'm making a sincere effort. I was blessed to be 12-step by a guy who only had 2.5 months of sobriety. His name was Gary. He's my age now. And he came there, and he wasn't there to be my sponsor. He wasn't there to get me into the steps. He was just a guy who was on fire for his recovery, who was an alumnus, who was coming back and just being a friend to people. And he could take people to outside meetings. He was one of those fortunate ones that still had a car and a license. And he came to my room, and he knocked. And he comes in. I go, what can I do for you? He says, you're on the list. I said, the list for what? He said, the list to go to the meeting. I said, what kind of meeting? He said, an AA meeting. Where's it at? He says, it's downtown. I said, we got to leave? He goes, yeah. I said, I'm not going to no meeting. No thanks, you know. And so he leaves, but then he does something beautiful. He comes back a few minutes later, and he opens the door, and he just sticks his head in. And he looks at me, and he says, I want you to do me a favor. I said, what's that? He goes, I want you to try really hard to smile and get her over with. And he left. And I'm sitting there thinking, what the hell does that mean, smile and get it over with? But it worked, because whatever. Next thing I know, I got this willingness I didn't have seconds before. And now I'm scouring the halls looking for him. And I find him. And I said, hey, are you still going to that meeting? He goes, yeah. I said, that's great. He says, that's great. I said, why is that great? He says, because I can't get anybody else to go. Then I knew I swallowed the hook. I go, what did I just do, you know? And so we go down, it's a little bitty treatment center, we go down to the parking lot, and we're walking across, and there it is, there's probably some out here tonight in the parking lot, the newcomer car, right? And I'm serious, we could pass the hat in that section right there and pay for this car. It was a 1970 pea green Plymouth Duster. No exhaust, no floorboards, rusted out, trash everywhere, old box speakers in the back seat, took up the whole back seat, hot wired stereo, trash everywhere. Get in this car, and he's totally stoked because he's taking the new guy to the meeting. And we're in a little bitty rural town where you drive downtown to the square where the churches are at, and that's where all the meetings are at. So he cranks his car up, boom, 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 no exhaust. And we take off, boom, and carbon monoxide's pouring through the floorboard. And you're trying not to die from asphyxiation, right? And he's got a smile wraps around his head. He's stoked he's got the new guy, and he starts giving me the AA pitch, telling me how great his life is. Now he's sober 2.5 months. And I'm looking at him, and I think I invented the word right there. I'm like, dude, I don't know if anybody's told you, but it looks like your life sucks to me, man. Yeah. But alcoholics are quick, even at 2.5 months of sobriety. He says, yeah, well, why don't you tell me about your car? I don't even have a car. He goes, and the rumor is you got a big trial coming up. How's that working for you, boy? You just stuck the knife right there. But an amazing thing happened. We got to the meeting, and he was calling me Harold the whole time, and I just took it. I guess it was on my sheet or whatever. That was my legal name. And I didn't fight anymore. He just says, Harold, we're going to go to this meeting. And this is the instructions you give me before we walk in. He said, we're going to go in this meeting tonight, and if they call on you, let's hope they don't call on you, but if they would call on you, you just tell them your name is Harold, and you're an alcoholic, and don't add anything to it. Because we know you probably huffed some of this, and you snorted some of that, and you smoked some of that. You're an Ozark hillbilly, and alcoholism has a big definition. It probably means you slept with a few farm animals, too. We know what it means. But don't add anything to it. Just be Harold the alcoholic if you go to this meeting. So, okay. So I went to the meeting, Harold the alcoholic, and I've been Harold the alcoholic ever since. Some of the best advice I ever got. The important message I want to leave you with that is that it was Ebby that went to Bill. It was Bill that went to Bob. And it was Gary that went to Harold. And I hopefully never lose that. It's real easy to hand out a phone list or a newcomer's packet. If you want it, what we got, call us. I would have never called you people. Ever called you people. I came back to St. Louis when I got out. I had a desire not to drink, but I didn't have a desire to go to AA. And I didn't go to AA. But this persistent friend, Gary, kept calling me. Harold, did you go to AA? No. Why? I don't know why. I didn't know why. He said, well, Harold, your life depends on it. I knew that was a true statement, and I didn't want it to be. I didn't want that to be a true statement. I didn't want to spend the rest of my life going to stuff like this. Because sobriety, and Steve gave us a great illustration of that last night, talking about the punitive nature of what recovery looked like. My definition of recovery and sobriety was very punitive. It was punitive. It's more like a sentence. You're going to not drink for the rest of your life. I didn't get excited about that. So I came back, and I was consumed with this trial. I had this big trial coming up. And he finally convinced me to go to my first meeting, and I went. I took a bus. I didn't have a license. I sat outside this place. I knew it was the right place, and I didn't have the courage to go into it. And I didn't. I went back home. He said, you go? I said, I tried to go. He goes, what do you mean you tried to go? I said, I went. I couldn't go in. Why? I don't know why. I was just terrified to walk into these rooms. Terrified. And finally, he got me to go. Now, what I want to tell you is this. There's three types of people that come to AA. There are those who make it happen, those who watch it happen, and those who don't know what's happening at all, right? And I've been all three of those cats. And I didn't know what was happening when I got here. And I watched it happen for the first 3 years. I don't recommend that for anybody. My first 3 years of sobriety are as much about what not to do as they are to do. But I'm going to share it with you. And so I came to AA. And I came with the same chip I had my whole life. I'm going to do what I want, when I want, how I want, the way I want. And if you don't like it, well, too bad for you, because that's how I flow. I don't want a sponsor because I've had a probation or parole officer my entire life. And I still got one. I don't want anybody else having say-so in my life. And I look at the steps, and the steps aren't going to change this guy. I mean, it's just not. I had too much materialism in my life. I had too much individualism and consumerism and secularism in my life. My mindset was, call me crazy, but I think I could be a little bit more spiritual if I had a few hundred dollars in my pocket and a driver's license and a better car and a girlfriend. You know, that's what I needed. This is part of that imposter narrative. This is what you got to have to be somebody. And if you don't have this, then you're not anybody. And that was so disconnected from anything spiritual. So this is my mindset. This is my goal. This is what I wanted to achieve. So therefore, I was on step none for the first 3 years. Right? If you were at the International, last International, the Friday night speaker made this statement. I'll never forget it. They said, you know, I was doing everything right in AA, but 12 things. Right? Well, that was me. I had a sober band, big band. We played all over the place. I was on the sober softball teams. We were going to sober dances. We dressed up like the Bee Gees. Seriously, I had big old jam pants and colored shirts, and we couldn't wait to say the Lord's Prayer so we could just bust it. We'd come to stuff like this just in time to go to the dance. Wasn't interested in anything going on here tonight, but that and chase the girls and do all that stuff, that's what I did. You can only live off that kind of recovery for so long, and then eventually you're going to leave, because this whole experience is about transformation, and I wasn't really getting transformed at all. And in 3 years, I finally burnt my life down, and I couldn't blame King Alcohol anymore. So I finally humbled myself to sponsorship. I humbled myself to the instructions you gave me the first day I was in AA. And I went and asked this guy to sponsor me. His name is Roy. And I went to Roy's house, and I said, Roy, will you sponsor me? And he knew me the whole time. He says, yeah, you know, come over. Let's talk about it. And I sat at his kitchen table. He said, Harold, you've been around for now for about 3 years. Tell me about your life. I said, well, I'm 25 years old. I live up the street. It's one of the reasons I asked you to sponsor me, because I can walk here. I live in the basement of a house. I don't have any education. I don't have a GED. I got a criminal record. I got a piece of crap car that I can't legally drive that's out in front of your house. It's held together by bumper stickers, but I drive it anyway. I don't have a license. I don't know if I ever have a license. I got a dead-end job. My life sucks just every which way you want to take it. Take the word sucks, capitalize it, highlight it, italicize it, make a neon sign out of it. That's where my life was at. And I shared it with him. And he listened gracefully. And he said, after I was done, he said, Harold, I hear everything you're saying. And there's no doubt that you've been dealt a pretty tough hand in your life. But I hope you're going to hear what I'm going to tell you. And what he said that night changed my life. And what he said that night is as true that night as it is as I sit here tonight with you on April 29, 2023. And this is what he said. He said, Harold, everything you have in your life right now, as you sit here at my kitchen table, every single thing you got going on, you've attracted to you by the person you become. And the day you're man enough to own that truth is the day you're on your way to some real change. But until you can own that truth, this little vicious cycle you're on, you're eventually going to drink again because you're not happy about your sobriety. And Sue lifted that up beautiful to us, what that looks like. Or you're going to do what my dad did. My dad could never stop drinking. He took a shotgun and he took his life. That's how my dad quit drinking. So you're going to do one or two things. You're either going to grow or you're going to go. And the million-dollar question is, what do you want to do? And I know there's people sitting here right now. That's where you're at. You're at that space. And you're either going to grow or you're going to go. We're inviting you to not go, but to grow. But you got to embrace a new way of life. You have to come to the end of yourself. For some people, that happens the moment they put down King Alcohol. They walk in here and go, I'm done. They get a sponsor day one, and they stay, and they never leave, and they have this amazing experience. And that happens for a lot of people. It just wasn't my experience. I really believe King Alcohol was my problem. You convinced me of that. That once I got this out of my life would explode into change. Couldn't be further from the truth. Obviously, I didn't quit going to jail, and the impunity stuff that would happen as a result of being drunk ended. But my life didn't get any better. My attitude didn't get any better. And so that had to change. I had to come to the end of ourselves. Right after ABC's How It Works, which we heard here tonight, it says, now we're at step three, and what do we mean by that, and what do? And it says, the first requirement is you've got to be convinced that any life run on self can hardly be a success. And it's easy to nod my head and say, yeah, I believe that. But my actions didn't lead into that. And I knew he was going to say, let's work the steps. I just didn't believe it would change my life, but I was at a desperate point. I was willing to do anything at this point. So we started this journey, and it tasted so good that I'd never stopped from that day till now. And it didn't happen one big cataclysmic explosion, but it changed my life. And what's important, I think, when we talk about the steps, so many times we talk about it in tense and very past tense forms. I worked the steps like I'm one and done. I check a box. I did the fifth step in 2004 or whatever. But it's a design for a living, and the principles behind it are a way of life. And I can either come all the way in, sit all the way down, and live with that, or I don't. And if I don't, I'm not going to stay here. I'm going to get sick of this stuff. I'm going to get sick of hearing how it works. I'm going to get sick of all of it. And I'm out of here. But if I embrace it, and I come all the way in, I really live into this thing, it'll change your freaking life. It changed my life. And again, it happened right. I end up getting a sponsor later on down the road named Tom I, a friend to many people here. To June and I are really connected because of Tom. Tom was my sponsor most of my sobriety, until he became ill with dementia. And then that's when Steve, and who I knew well at the time, became my sponsor. And we've been walking that journey ever since. And Tom died on September 2nd last year. He died with 65 years of sobriety. Amazing, amazing AA guy. Tom taught me how to become a Three Legacy member. Tom taught me so many things. I don't have all night to talk about it. But one of the things he told me right off the bat, he said, he made this statement, it's a famous quote of his, but he told it to me many times. He said, Harold, when preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction, great things will happen in your life. But I wasn't prepared for any opportunities that came my way. If they came, they go right past me. I wasn't mature enough. I wasn't sober enough. I just wasn't enough to even embrace them or live into them. But as I started to work the steps, another quote Tom would always say is that when God's got work for you to do, the walls come down. And it couldn't be truer. I mean, the opportunities came, and 2 + 2 didn't equal 4 anymore. I call it spiritual mathematics. It's where the impossible becomes possible in this journey. And things started to pop. Things started to happen. My life started to take off. And I've been rocking and rolling ever since. I was able to reconcile with my mom after 3 years of sobriety. And when I did, she says, I want you to come to work for me. She worked at this point for a major insurance organization. And she wanted me to work for them, but she wanted me to work for her. And I said, well, Mom, they're never going to hire me to work for you. Not with my past. They're never going to do it. And she goes, well, let me worry about that. And she got me to the interview. I'll never forget going to the interview with the president of this major organization. I had to go borrow a tie from my neighbor. I didn't even own a tie. And he would work for Budweiser, so he didn't wear ties. He had a clip-on tie that came down to about right here. And I show up at this interview. I look pathetic. And the guy who was the vice president who eventually hired me became the president, became a great friend of mine. But this is what he said. He says, the only reason you're here is because of your mom. It's the only reason you're here. And if I hire you, you're going to do 3 things. You're going to do them well. You're going to work hard, you're going to work smart, and you're going to work honest. And if you can't do those 3 things, you won't be here. Do you understand that? I said, yes, sir. And he says, get out of here. And he eventually hired me. And And I lived into those three things, and it changed my life. And I got opportunities I didn't deserve, and I made a lot of money. I got a lot of initials behind my name. And I got married, I had kids, things were rocking and rolling, but eventually I capped out and I couldn't go any further. Now I'm double digit sobriety in my 30s, and I can't go any further because I don't have an education. He says, they just told me, you can't go any further. You don't even qualify to work here right now. I don't even know how you got here, but you can't go any further. And so my sponsor said, go get a GED. I said, well, I tried to get a GED while I was incarcerated. I couldn't complete the task. Because I quit school when I was 13. He says, well, then go sign up for community college. I said, you want me to go sign up for community college and take GED classes? He goes, that's exactly what I want you to do. So I signed up. You know, I already had gray hair going on. I had to wear a suit and tie every day to work. So I show up to the GED class at the community college. And they thought I was the professor when I walked in. They did. They thought I was teaching the class. I said, no, I'm here. And I sat right in the front where I didn't have to look at everybody else. Because they looked like characters out of Star Wars, if you know what I mean. You know, when I pierced my ear in the 70s, that was a big deal in the country to pierce your ear. But now people were all tatted out and they had enough nuts and bolts and they looked like they fell down in the nut and bolt section at Lowe's. I mean, they looked a lot different than I did. And this kid sitting next to me, his name was Robbie. And Robbie, leather jacket, chains, spike wristbands, tattoos, mohawk, shaved head here, mohawk, 10 different colors. Right where you're sitting, and he looked like he belonged in a museum. And I, you know, the teacher's not even here, and I'm looking at him, and he's looking at me, and he jumps bat on me right there in the middle of the class. He goes, what are you looking at, old man? That's what he asked me right there in front of everybody. And being quick on my feet, I remember a lot of humor, and I said, well, you know what, Robbie? To be honest with you, I said, I made love with a parrot one time. And I'm wondering if you might be one of my kids. And even Robbie smiled at that one. 16 weeks later, Robbie's right next to me. Another guy's here. I graduate. I go on to get a 4 years later, I walk across the stage and get a bachelor's degree. And I sent my mom a bumper sticker and said, hey, your kid made the honor roll. The big joke in the family. A few years later, I walk across stage and got a master's degree. And I wrote a thesis for starting a business from scratch. And I did that, and I sold it, and I did not just do it once. I did it twice, and I'm right in the beginnings of doing it a third time. Eventually walked across the stage and got another master's degree. The impossible becomes possible here. I had to make amends to my family. Started with my mom. My mom was the greatest winner of my life. In 2013, Mother's Day is coming up. On 2013, I invited my mom to go to Mother's Day brunch. Come to church, and I'm going to give the message to church. My mom was a diehard Catholic. I was in a Protestant setting, and they asked me to do the message that Sunday, and I said, I would love to. I said, I'm going to bring my mom, and she sat right where you're at, mom along. And the senior pastor, Pastor Keith, came out, and he had two plants in his hand. I didn't know any of this was happening. He says, I got two plants to give out today. One is to this woman here who's been with the church since Moses parted the Red Sea, and everybody clapped, you know, and they gave her the plant. It was a great thing. And he says, the other one is to Mama Long, who's with us today, Harold's mom. And he walks down to her, walks down there with a mic, a wireless mic, hands her the plant, says, congratulations, happy Mother's Day. We want to thank you for everything you've done in this kid's life because he means so much to us and everybody here. And we just want to thank you for that. And they hand her the microphone. And my mom's like taken back, and she grabs her microphone. And this is her exact words, friend. She says, don't thank me for that boy's life. Thank Alcoholics Anonymous. She handed it in the lap. And I winked at her. I said, thanks, Mom. You just blew my anonymity in front of 500 people. In 2015, my mom got gravely ill, came down with small cell lung cancer, put in the hospital, lived 8 days. But as I sat with her in the hospital, the last days of her life, and my kids were there, and and nieces and nephews and siblings, and I looked around the room. I was good with everybody. I didn't know anybody, nothing. I was fully reconciled with everybody in that room. Just an amazing life. And the night before she died, I took a set of earphones and I put her on her head, and she opened her eyes for the last time. You could see death in her eyes. And she said, you know, she was startled. She couldn't talk. I said, don't worry about it, Mom. All I'm doing is putting in a CD for you, Frank Sinatra, because she loved Frank Sinatra. In her last words, she goes, everybody needs a little blue eyes. And so I got a poster hanging in my house with Frank Sinatra, and in the corner it says, for Mama Long, everybody loves a little blue eyes. And she died. You know, and my siblings asked me to do the eulogy and honor my mother, and what a privilege that is. Hardest message I ever had to give in my life, but a beautiful way to send off. I did a lot of amends, and my sponsor had me put my my amends list on 3x5 index cards, and I had a stack of these things when I started. But some of them I really didn't feel like that I needed to do, because they were just like things that were just really by omission, things that I never really did. And one of them was my dad's brother. I never really knew my dad. I only saw my dad a few times. And the last time I saw my dad alive, he came to Hillsboro, Missouri, where I was sentenced. He came to that trial. That was the last time I saw my dad alive. But it was his brother. And he says, because we were going through this list, and it was Uncle Bob. And he says, well, put him on your list. And I said, why do I got to put him on my list? He goes, because he's your family member. I said, yeah, but I never did anything to this guy. I think I saw him once or twice when I was maybe 5 or 6 years old. He says, put him on the list. And so every year he went to the back. Immediately he'd come up, he'd go to the back immediately for 5 years, 10 years. Now we're 12 years into it. I'm 12 years sober. And I only got a few cards left. And Uncle Bob's on it. I'm in the prison one night. And we're doing a 9-step workshop. And we're talking about this. And I just talk about this amends I'm unwilling to make. And one of the guys inside called me out on it. He says, hey, man, when are you going to just shut up and do it? And I went home kind of resentful, and I thought about it, and I thought, well, man, he's right. I mean, I don't even know if this guy's still alive. But I had a willingness I didn't have for 12 years, and I got up and I Googled Robert and Betty Long, and it pops up Buffalo, Missouri. I said, well, that's got to be my Uncle Bob and my Aunt Betty. It has to be. So I sent him a little card, tell him what's going on. Within a week, I get a card back. They're all excited to hear all my twisted delusions, why they didn't want anything to do with me, why they never reached out to me, blah, 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 all delusions. All false. And they were totally excited to hear from me. And my Aunt Betty eventually called me. And she called me and she said, I just want to make sure that you got that card. I said, I got that card, Aunt Betty. And she goes, I said, I really need to come and see you in person, though. I said, this process of reconciliation, making amends, we do that face-to-face. So can I come and see you guys? She goes, well, I don't know about all that amends stuff you're talking about, but, man, we would love to see you. So come on. So I drove to Buffalo, Missouri, 3.5 hours away. We talk about the 12 promises in the book, but there's another set of there's another promise in that 9-step that goes overlooked sometimes. And it says this, and I'm paraphrasing, it says that 9 times out of 10, the unexpected happens. And that's been my experience. As grandiose as I can be, 9 times out of 10 is going to go better than anything I could have planned. I drive to Buffalo, Missouri. I pull down Locust Street, 3,300 people in this little town. And there's their house, little single-story ranch, pull into the driveway. They got 3 cars. There's 1 spot for me. There's cars on both sides of the street. I thought, damn, these people got a lot of cars for being an old bunch of old people. And I get out, and I'm a nervous wreck. Like on any amends I've ever made, I'm a nervous wreck. And I get out. My Aunt Betty comes to the front door, little country lady, and she's got the door open. She's looking at me, and she's reporting to whoever's behind the house. And she says, well, he looks like a Long. And I knew I had the right house. And I walk up, and my Uncle Bob comes out on the front porch. And I came out, and he steps out there. I hadn't seen this guy since a little kid. And he grabs my hand, and he squeezes it. He looks me right in my eyes. He says, welcome home, son. I want you to come inside. I got some people I want you to meet. And I walked in, and every one of his kids and grandkids and cousins, and there's probably about 30 people to welcome me back into their life. And it melted my heart. But at the same time, I was totally grieving over the fact that this extreme self-centeredness that had robbed me my entire life, had robbed me all this time, because that amends was there from day one. There's Uncle Bob's story sitting here tonight. So unfinished business. I can promise you I've heard a lot more fourth and fifth steps than I ever have eighth and ninth steps. So this whole thing, as I get ready to wrap up here, this whole thing with delusion, this delusion, the overcoming the big delusions, alcoholism, delusion number one being that I'm not alcoholic, kills most of us. But the second big delusion I think we have to overcome is that we come here and we admit, we can concede, I can finally concede, say my name's Harold, I'm an alcoholic, but it's not my fault. And I don't say it that way because it sounds too pathetic, but that's really what I'm saying, because the book says that it concluded others as wrong is about as far as most of us ever got. That is as far as I ever got. So I was stuck in that victimization. My life sucks because of you. And the problem is, if you're stuck in that, the big time problem with it is you can drink yourself to death and it's not your fault. You can blow your veins out, you can blow your lungs out, you can blow your nostrils out, you can blow your brains out, and it's not your fault. You can sit in a 9x7 or 10x6 jail cell for the rest of your life, and it's not your fault. And that's got to go, or you're not going to stay. And steps 4 through 9 help me do that. You know, you just visualize a channel, this channel between us and the heavenly realm, the world of the spirit, heaven itself, God, higher power, however you got to reference it. You know, if there's a bridge between me and God and something's blocking the bridge, nothing's getting across the bridge. And there was a lot of stuff blocking the bridge, stuff that had been there long before I ever picked up a drink. All my junk, all the sexual abuse I suffered, physical abuse, verbal abuse, going down the line, the resentments, the crimes I committed I never got caught for, all this stuff was in my channel. And it blocked me between that and that power. It blocked me from you. And these steps help me get past that, but it brings you right up against that next delusion that I suffer from deeply, and it was the fact that I could admit I was alcoholic, I could finally own myself, I could own my junk and say that it's my fault, I take full responsibility. But let's just be real with each other. I broke too many hearts, I burnt too many bridges, there's little hope my life's ever going to really amount to anything, so why even try? That's why we have a recidivism rate in our prison system 60-70%, because people are already giving up before they ever get started. The discouragement sets in, and you just quit. And people go in and out of treatment centers. I've been in 17, you know, however many, I've been in 17 treatment centers, in and out of Skid Row, whatever. It's the same thing. It's their whole life, their soul, our soul being made up of our mind, our will, and our emotions, is full of discouragement. And I'm just telling you, it's a delusion. If you come all the way in, sit all the way down, and stay here, you'll overcome that. But if you're sitting here with that delusion, it's powerful. And it will keep you paralyzed. It will keep you stagnant. It will kill you. But I was able to overcome that. I had to come up against the delusion of spiritual disqualification. The delusion that, you know, because of who I was, the things I did, the way I treated people, the way I thought, the way I still act today at times, that disqualified me somehow. And the steps helped me know that that's not true. That I could finally accept God's grace in my life. Truly feel like I was a forgiven person. And I've been able to live into that, and it changed my life. And so if you struggle with the whole idea of a higher power, I just encourage you to stay here, engage the steps with a sponsor, especially 4 through 9. Just go through that work. And this commitment, this connection you're going to have with this power is going to meet you on the other side of that. You're going to have that connection, and it's going to change your life. But the delusion in front of it can keep you from it. And I just tell you just to embrace it. And I could sit and talk about that subject for weeks. It's a delusion. But the last delusion is a delusion that there's no real purpose for my life. I do all this work, and for what? I mean, come on, let's just be real. I got a broken life. I got a track record that'll never be reconciled. You know, so what purpose is there really to it? But then I get past that delusion because that's all we talk about here. We talk about our primary purpose and our singleness of purpose and our group purpose and, of course, our real purpose, which is to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and people in life. Our purpose is to become the people we were always meant to be. And if you're here tonight, especially if you're new, I'm just telling you the best version of you is yet to come if you come all the way into this thing. And God will do amazing things through your life. I told you I'm a dad, I'm a grandpa. I live this incredible life. I sponsor a lot of guys. Yeah, there's bumps in the road, but I'm very accountable to my sponsor. I do nightly review with my sponsor every night, half for years. I do with the guys I sponsor and they with them. And we just do a lot of accountability, spiritually grounded, spiritually centered stuff. But what I want to leave you with is what really changed my life. My sponsor said there's two things you need to do well. And if you do these two things well, one day at a time for the rest of your life, you're going to have a storybook life. And these are those two things. Number one, you always have a new guy you're working with. And if you don't have a new guy, you stop what you're doing, you get out your rods, you get out your bait, you go fish where there's fish. But you always have a new guy you're on this journey with. Page 100, first full paragraph, one of the greatest promises in the book. I'll let you read that on your own. But the other thing is you got to go somewhere once a week where you don't want to end up. I don't care where it's at. It could be Skid Row, it could be a treatment center, it could be a halfway house, county jail, prison, I don't care. But you need to go somewhere once a week where you don't want to end up. And that started for me in 1990 in the Skid Row missions in St. Louis at a place called Harbor Light Salvation Army. I went there every Thursday and every Saturday for 3 years. Toughest day I ever did in my life. And in 1993, I got a phone call that says, "Hey, man, would you come down to this prison and give a talk?" And I started laughing. I said, "Dude, do you know who you're talking to?" And he goes, "Yeah, I know who I'm talking." I said, "They're not going to let me come back into prison. Are you nuts?" And he goes, "No, you've been on paper long enough, and I got a lot of clout here. I'm pretty sure I can get you in here." I said, "Well, let's just pretend that's true. I made a promise a long time ago. I ain't ever, never, ever going back on that side of the fence for you or anybody else." And he laughed, and he said, "Well, run that by your sponsor and call me back." Well, you know how that went. And so I made my way into a maximum security system, which I'm very much a part of today, 30 years later. And I'm there every week, have been for 30 years. And I can sit here all night and share stories with you on how that's blessed my life. I'll share one because it ties to my friend Pat, who's here, and it ties to one of the ladies she sponsors, and I'll share it tonight as I close out. In 1996, we've been in the prison now for about 3 years, and we weren't really making traction with people. We had great meetings, lots of enthusiasm, but we weren't into the steps. And we knew we had to get these guys in the steps. So we wrote a whole workshop right out of the big book, especially for prisons, and we started doing these workshops, these 12-step workshops. And a group of guys came in. All these guys were lifers. One of these guys' name was Brent. Brent had two life sentences, second-degree murder for killing his father and armed criminal action. Came to prison in 1987. And, and he drank while he was still in prison, burned his life into the ground. 10 years into it, his wife divorced him, his mom left, nobody would come and stay anymore. He came into the prison just like everybody comes into the prison. He came into the prison like everybody comes into AA. They come in with their hands crossed. And what do? They listen with their eyes and they think with their feelings. I hope you hear that. They listen with their eyes and they think with their feelings. So he came in, and it took about 6 months for his arms to come down, but he got into the step workshop. He signed up for it, and the same 12 steps that transformed my life and continue to transform my life transformed his life. And quickly, as he started to work the steps, he started to change, and his mama got back on his visiting list after years of not seeing him. And eventually, his grandma came and saw him, and eventually, his wife heard what was going on. She came back and re-reconciled, recommitted her vows, and they got married again while he was in prison, not knowing if he'd ever get out. In 2006, he walked into our prison group with a smile that wrapped around his head. He says, "You're never going to believe it." And I said, "What's that?" He says, "I got an out date." I said, "You got to be kidding me." He says, "No, I'm going home in 2008. So 21 years to the day. He did 21 years today. In 2008, he came home. And I said, "Now you call me every day until I tell you not to." I've talked to him every day since. But he called me on the way home. And he says, "Hey, man, I'm out. And I'm on this thing called a cell phone, man. It's awesome." I said, "Yeah, dude, I got one. I've been using it for years." I said, "You get home, enjoy your family, call me in the morning." One of the greatest phone calls I ever got in my life. He called me the next day. He says, "Man, you're going to never guess what I'm doing." I said, "Well, let's see. You haven't been with your wife for 21 years? Brother, I know what you've been doing." He says, "No, I'm not talking about that." I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "I've been sitting here all morning opening gifts." I said, "What kind of gifts?" He goes, "Father's Day gifts, Christmas gifts, and birthday gifts since 1996. He says, "You're never going to guess what I got for Christmas in 97. And I said, "What did you get?" He said, "I got a Miami Dolphins jacket." He'd never been to a game in his life. I don't know why he liked the Dolphins. But if the Rams, the L.A. Rams, used to be the St. Louis Rams, right? They were still in St. Louis. I said, "Well, this is a spiritual mathematics." I said, "I got 4 tickets right here for you to see the Dolphins play the Rams in 4 weeks here in St. Louis." He said, "Man, that's insane." He goes, "Who am I going to take?" I said, "You take whoever you want." He said, "Will you go?" I said, "Hell yeah, I'll go." He says, "We'll get Big Book Bob. Big Book Bob had life in 40. And we'll get Gary, who had life in 20. And all these guys got sober in that workshop in that prison meeting in 1996. And the walls come down and 2 + 2 = 4. And they were out living productive lives. And we're at this game having the time of our life. And the woman behind us at halftime said, "Hey, man, I've been watching you guys." I said, "Yeah." She goes, "You guys are having a lot of fun." I said, "Yeah, we are." She goes, "You guys aren't even drinking." I said, no, ma'am, we're not. She goes, it's a good thing. And I said, why is that? She goes, because the way you guys are carrying on, you'd probably end up in prison or something. Huh? I'll leave you with this, and this is what Sue left us with, but it's true. There's a question on page 152. Ask the question, do you have a sufficient substitute for King alcohol? And the answer is yes, and it's vastly more than that. It's a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope you read that in the big book, because it's not in the noun form. It's in the verb form, meaning that you have to participate in your own recovery. But if you come all the way in, you sit all the way down, and you stay here, the most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. You're going to make some lifelong friends, evidence here tonight. Your imagination is going to get fired, but here's the biggest kicker. You're going to have the ability and the experience to walk shoulder to shoulder with other people and help them rediscover life. And if you do that long enough, you're going to finally know what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. I'm totally convinced in 36 years of sobriety that we're not meant, God never meant for us to know God intellectually. God meant for us to know each other experientially. But you can't do that if you're a taker. You have to get this channel clear. You have to get die to yourself. You have to come to the end of yourself. You got to make this shift from a taker to the giver. But when you do, you learn to be able not only to receive love, but you learn how to start giving it. And I believe the best way I can honor God today is by loving you. And I couldn't do that when I got here. But I can do that today. And it's freaking awesome. And I owe it to you guys for that, the ability to do that. And I think it's the highest level of maturity. If there's such a thing as emotional sobriety, there is such a thing as spiritual maturity, it looks like this. It's when, in my circles, that who's ever excluded, who's ever wounded, who's ever suffering, isn't when they're around me. Because I can love them enough today to make a difference in how their life turns out. You played a big role in how my life turned out. So I thank you from the bottom of my heart for the privilege to come. And I thank you for my life. That's all I got.
Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12stepTapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12steptapes.com for more information.